ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 15th of January. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. The government has just a matter of days to secure support for proposed new hate speech and gun control reforms, a key part of its response to tackle anti-Semitism in the wake of the Bondi terror attack. The Prime Minister has recalled Parliament to debate the legislation on Tuesday, but it's attracted criticism and calls for amendments. For more on this, Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke joins me. Minister, thanks very much for joining us on the program this morning.
Good morning.
You've said these new hate speech laws will test constitutional limits and will likely be subject to court challenges. The proposed legislation offers a defence to those directly quoting from religious texts. This has attracted criticism and been described as a loophole, notably by the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. Was this exemption included intentionally to offer some freedom of speech protection? Or is it an oversight?
We, in acknowledging freedom of religion, we didn't want a situation where somebody is not engaging in hate speech, is simply quoting religious texts, and we didn't want them to be inadvertently caught. That's all being examined now by the committee, and so the committee report will come back on the best way to go with that. But that's certainly the reason that the government's included it.
So it sounds like it was intentional. As I said, the Executive Council of Australian Jewry described it as a loophole, misconceived and unnecessary. Do their concerns have to be ignored to make sure that there are those protections there for freedom of speech?
The fact that that's their view matters. We also want to make sure that people who are not engaging in hate don't inadvertently get caught up. So that's the reason that is there is for a good reason. And the arguments that are put by the Executive Council of Australian Jury are well put. It'll be weighed up by the committee.
Another call that's come out of those committee meetings, both from Muslim and Jewish groups, is a push to expand these laws beyond just racial discrimination, but to also offer protection to religious groups, those with a disability, the LGBTQ community groups that are also targeted by neo-Nazis. There's been some suggestion by your colleagues that maybe this could be looked at after this bill passes Parliament. If it does, would you support that?
We've been careful with this legislation that Parliament's being recalled early, specifically because of the Bondi attack, and that's why we've dealt with the head of the category, I guess, of discrimination and hate speech that was directly the form of bigotry that was in the minds of the terrorists.
The National Imams Council have said that they do feel like their community will be targeted by these new laws, but that there is no protection from Islamophobia. Do you think it is something that needs to be looked at?
Yesterday afternoon, I was in the office of Julian Hill, and we had a cup of tea with an imam and his wife who had been viciously attacked on the streets of Melbourne on Saturday. Good Australians, great people who'd been subjected to horrific bigotry. The need to be able to confront all forms of bigotry is real. And it's essential. The Prime Minister has flagged a process going forward to be able to look at the other categories of hate.
So the time maybe is it now, but you would like to see that looked at in the future?
Well, the Prime Minister's flagged that there'll be a process to work through how we would deal with other categories of hate.
Now, these laws would also offer you, as Home Affairs Minister, the power to ban so-called hate groups. You identified two groups, Hizbut Tahrir and also the neo-Nazi National Socialist Network, as key targets of these laws. The NSN has now disbanded to avoid arrest. Was that good news for you?
Any day the Nazis take a step backwards is a good day. And if there was ever evidence that this legislation is urgent and that we've got the balance right in what we've put forward, it's that immediately on seeing it, the Nazis announced that they're going to disband. These arguments that are coming from the Liberal Party now, having spent all the last week after week calling for the early return of Parliament and saying how urgently we need to legislate, to now say, oh no, you're rushing us, is just ridiculous. We're getting immediate action from some of these groups. Notorious Prayer Hall has said now that it's permanently closed. The Nazis are taking a significant step backwards. None of this means that the hate in these individuals goes away, but it is making it more and more difficult for them to organise. And that's why I can't for the life of me see how the Liberal Party have got themselves to the point where they're now effectively opposing the legislation. And one of their senior figures, Andrew Hastie, saying we shouldn't be doing anything until the Royal Commission's reported. That's more than a year away.
Minister, as you say, these laws don't remove the hate from the minds of these people. And some experts warn that maybe inadvertently these laws have pushed those members underground and might make it harder to monitor them.
I'd go straight to the testimony of Mike Burgess, the Director General of ASIO, yesterday, where he said that groups may well go underground, and that's then their job to monitor them. And they've got highly skilled people doing that.
Do you expect you can get a deal with the Greens to get this through the Parliament on this self-imposed timeline of by discussing in Parliament Tuesday next week?
We could not have been given a more serious impetus for urgent action than the horrors that we saw. And to be able to respond to that, we need to be able to deal with the motivation and the method that was used by those terrorists. They had bigotry in their minds and they had guns in their hands. We need to deal with the why and the how. The legislation deals with both, and we shouldn't be wasting. And I still hold out some vain hope, maybe, that even the coalition will not just go into the absolute depths of hypocrisy. And if they won't listen to the government, listen to the claims that they themselves made week after week over the last month. Because all the arguments are there as to why this legislation needs to be passed.
We'll all be watching their reaction over the coming days. There's also been a lot of discussion about what to do with the footbridge in North Bondi that was used by the gunman during the Bondi attack. As a Member of Parliament, but also a Sydney sider yourself, do you have a personal view on what you'd like to see happen there?
I accept whatever the families want, but I've got to say that I actually had remarked to some people very early on following the attack that I thought we would end up with that bridge being removed.
Minister, we know it's a busy week for you, so thank you very much for joining us on AM today.
Great to be back. Thanks.
Tony Burke is the Home Affairs Minister. Now, more than a month after the Bondi Beach terror attack, a local council meeting tonight will discuss efforts to support the community and honour the victims. As we just discussed with the Home Affairs Minister, one point of contention is the future of a footbridge used by the two gunmen. The New South Wales Premier has called for its demolition, but others say it should stay and become a memorial. Isabel Massali reports.
In a Sydney warehouse, a mammoth effort is underway to preserve the flowers that were left as tributes to the victims after the Bondi terror attack. Leading the project is Jewish artist Nina Zanadze.
It takes the whole huge community to bring the 3 tons of flowers, to hang them up to dry. It was hundreds of people volunteering. And now I have every day 30 to 50 people coming to the warehouse where we're drying them, sorting them.
The artwork will be displayed at the Sydney Jewish Museum. But she says the attack must be remembered in other ways too. While discussions continue about whether the bridge used by the gunmen should be torn down, she thinks it should remain as a community memorial paved by flowers.
It is what it is. We have to stand there, be brave enough to stand there as a place of remembrance.
A 2024 report commissioned by the Waverley Council states the heritage-listed footbridge is reaching the end of its life and requires replacement within several years. But the recent tragedy leaves another issue to consider.
My personal view is that it would be better to be knocked down.
New South Wales Premier Chris Minns.
It's the council's responsibility, and I understand they're speaking with the victims and their families, and I think they should have the final say. But I just hate it to be a ghoulish reminder or even exploited by reprehensible people in the future.
If they were to demolish the bridge, it's adding insult to injury.
That's Harvey Israel.
Basically, as a survivor who was shielding my baby and having people shot dead next to me, I feel very strongly that the bridge should definitely stay there. It's important for people to understand just what we were going through. And when you go up to that bridge, it will remind everyone.
It's a view shared by Simone Abel from the Executive Council of Australian Jewry.
I think it's important that there is some kind of a memorial and that actually the footbridge remains, although, you know, sealed off, because one of the things that our community experiences very frequently is denial, minimisation of attacks against Jews.
Linda Ben-Menashe is the president of the National Council of Jewish Women and is based in Sydney.
Bondi Beach belongs to all Australians, and that bridge is part of so many people's memories.
George Newhouse acknowledges it's not a simple decision, but wants to see a proper and open process. He's a human rights lawyer and former mayor of Waverley Council.
This is a matter that really does need community consultation, and the outcome should be one that both the council and the community shares.
In a statement last month, the council said it's aware of a wide range of views, and any decision making will require community consultation.
Isabel Misali reporting there. Human rights advocates warn a wave of executions of anti-regime demonstrators in Iran is imminent. The country's judiciary has promised speedy trials and sentencing for protesters, with some already facing the death penalty. One US-based organization has already verified 2,400 killings, but others are reporting the figure is actually as high as 12,000. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
In a procession broadcast live on Iranian state television, coffins covered in flags moved slowly through the streets of Tehran. The mass funeral was organised by the government for members of Iran's security forces and some civilians killed during recent deadly anti-regime protests. There are more deaths at the hands of the authorities still to come, which many fear. In vision also broadcast by Iranian state TV, the head of the country's judiciary was seen visiting a prison and interrogating a man accused of rioting. Human rights organisations have verified at least 18,000 people have been detained in the last fortnight, the crimes they're likely charged with carrying the death penalty. Supreme Court Chief Justice Gholam Hossein Mohseini Ejayi promising trials and sentencing would be swift.
If a person burned someone, beheaded someone, and set them on fire, then we must do our work quickly.
There's no evidence provided by the regime to back up claims such as those of beheading, but regardless, the Chief Justice is trying to justify the speed.
If things are delayed, it's even possible that the same action we take today we'd be taking 2 months later, and it wouldn't have the same effect.
One of the first expected to be executed is 26-year-old Irfan Sultani, arrested a week ago, rushed through the courts, with his family notified he'd be executed. Updates on his situation are hard to come by, as communications in and out of Iran remain blocked in many cases. The promise from the Iranian judiciary of fast punishment is a direct affront to this comment from the US President Donald Trump, speaking to American network CBS yesterday about how and when he would intervene to protect the protesters demanding the end of the regime.
I haven't heard about the hanging. If they hang them, you're going to see some things that I don't know what where you come from and what your thought process is, but you'll perhaps be very happy.
What do you mean by that?
We will take very strong action. If they do such a thing, we will take very strong action.
Anticipation and at this point speculation about how Donald Trump will act is prompting movement across the Middle East. Qatar's government confirming some US personnel are withdrawing from the Al Udeid base outside Doha as a precaution. It's the largest US base in the region, and the development is reminiscent of what happened 6 months ago during the Israel-Iran war, in the hours before Iranian forces fired missiles at the facility. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
Hundreds of thousands have been without power in Ukraine's capital for days as winter temperatures dip as low as minus 19 degrees. Russia has ramped up drone and missile attacks on power stations over the past week, including the firing of a hypersonic ballistic missile. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss reports.
In pop-up tents across the city, generators are the only way to keep warm.
I wear socks. Sometimes I wear warm felt boots and sleep in a woolen sweater. We're kind of worried, but what can we do?
Alina has had intermittent electricity for days. Half of the city went dark on Friday after a barrage of overnight strikes, which included a hypersonic ballistic missile, striking infrastructure just outside the western city of Lviv.
That's when they attacked us very hard, when they damaged our thermal power plant. It's been a week of very harsh conditions, but we're okay, we will endure.
71-year-old pensioner Ludmila has just returned to her home. Such happiness, she says. The electricity is back on. She and her husband had been staying at a temporary shelter near their apartment.
I was asleep on the sofa, covered myself with two blankets. It took some time to warm up, but nonetheless, I didn't have a good night's sleep because the cold doesn't allow you to sleep good. Nonetheless, we got through.
Some days, the power is restored for just half an hour and the pipes transporting the energy are frozen. These workers are using blow torches to unfreeze them. Kyiv's mayor Vitaly Klitschenko has urged residents to temporarily leave the city if they can.
Our communal workers are working day and night to repair and to provide heating. It's a difficult operation.
Despite the outages, residents remain stoic. Yulia is 8 months pregnant and has a three-year-old daughter.
For me, shelling is much worse. That's what really knocks me out of my normal life and disrupts my normal routine. Shelling adds a lot of anxiety. Night shelling, lack of sleep. You worry because there are ballistics flying. Your doors and windows are shaking.
These might be trying conditions, but for the Ukrainians who've stayed, they've seen it all before. The war is nearing the end of its fourth year, with no real end in sight. This is Catherine Diss in London, reporting for AM.
Residents in northeast Victoria are starting the rebuild after devastating bushfires tore through their community. The Longwood blaze burnt through 137,000 hectares and destroyed more than 340 structures. Volunteers in the region are coming together to start repairing critical infrastructure. Kathleen O'Connor reports from the town of Ruffey.
We're just on Goba Longwood Road. It's one of the main roads where the fires just tore through this area. I'm just seeing massive trees that are just black. You can hear chainsaws in the distance. We've been escorted in here by a CFA strike team, but we've also been followed in by some beautiful volunteers. They're just helping to fix some of the fences here and also just help cut down some more trees and just give the CFA a bit of a hand.
Mark Goodall is a resident in Longwood East. He grew up here and is one of the volunteers who is lending a hand.
Just clean up the fence lines, take a bit of pressure off the manager and the owner, just so they assess what they've got and whether they can hang on to some stock or whether they can have to offload it. Hopefully we get some rain in the autumn and it'll bounce back. Until then, we're going to sort of make do with what we've got. So.
And your house is okay and your family's okay?
Yes, our place was all right. It came in on all sides, but we managed to keep it sort of back a fair bit. On Thursday, we had to go and save my father's house. He lost a few sheds and that, but we saved the house, which is the main thing.
You've also got a 16-year-old just here who's on the chainsaw helping out, and he's lost everything.
Yes, he has, yeah. There was two houses on the property and, the whole lot's gone. So, credit to him. He's out here helping others out.
Just over the hill in Ruffey, many buildings have been burnt to the ground, including a church.
So we're now at a church in Ruffey. Not much of it is left standing. The roof has completely caved in. The fencing around the side has just been torn. What's left of the building looks like it's going to collapse. You can just see the blackened window frames from where the glass is just shattered from the heat. The locals wanted us to come here and just report on the fact that it's been destroyed. Lots of corrugated iron, just crumpled mess, and a cross in the ground. It's all that's left of this church.
Kathleen O'Connor reporting from Ruffey. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump says help is on its way for the Iranians who have taken to the streets in the biggest uprising since the 1979 revolution. But what does he mean by help? Is he ready to order military strikes as the death toll continues to climb into the thousands? Today, Hussein Abish from the Arab Gulf States Institute on what to expect in the days ahead. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.